don't know about you, but ever since the pandemic especially, all of a sudden, it seems like everyone is a bird enthusiast. I have people who are installing bird feeders or hummingbird feeders on their homes, and people who are investing in nice binoculars and cameras and getting their kids into it. It's really exciting. It's wonderful. I love it. I come from a bird-loving family, so I've always understood the phenomenon around them, but more and more people seem to be interested in them. And so we're trying to do more and more check-ins, actually, by request from all of you, with the Connecticut Audubon Society. And so Tom Anderson comes on the show pretty frequently, and we talk about either stories that pertain to some of our bird populations, trends that are going on, conservation efforts, anything having to do with our own backyards and especially the birds out there. And I came across a really nice local story about one tough little bird that seems to be doing really well, having a record year actually at Milford Point. So I wanted Tom to come on and share the story with us. And a reminder, Tom is the editor of Connecticut State of the Birds and the director of communication for the Connecticut Audubon Society. Hey, Tom, how are you?
Hey, I'm good, Melissa. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much. So tell me a little bit, first of all, which bird was profiled this week and why are we seeing such success this summer?
Well, we're talking about a little shorebird called the piping plover, and it's about the size of, not quite as big as a robin, so it's small. They nest only on beaches, and they are protected as a threatened species under the Federal Endangered Species Act, and they're listed as an endangered species in Connecticut. So there aren't many of them. Connecticut Audubon is, and the other thing about them is that not only are they small, but they have evolved so that their feathers are almost perfectly camouflaged when they're on the beach nesting and raising their young. It's really hard to see them because they look like the beach. They look like, you know, shells and rocks and grass. All
really,
unless they fly or scamper along the sand, it's hard to pick them out.
Oh, they do. I'm looking at pictures of them. Wow, they really do look like the beach. I think if they just hid their little beaks and their feet, you really couldn't see them. That's crazy.
It's very difficult, and that's a good protection against predators. You know, lots of things will eat small birds, crows and foxes and raccoons. The problem with it is that for people who are walking along the beach, it's hard to see them, and sometimes the babies will get stepped on. The nests are really hard to find because the way they make a nest is they simply make a slight little depression in the sand, and then they lay eggs that look just like stones.
Oh, my gosh. You know, that would be so scary if I were a mama bird. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I would think that anyone would just step on them, let alone eat them, because I guess they would think it looks like rocks. But, oh, that's
well,
so scary.
That and the fact that they nest only on you know, beaches where, you know, they're not a nest in great numbers, for example, at Hammonasset State Park, where, you know, they get thousands of people during the summer day. But at Milford Point, which is a nature preserve, they've been nesting for years. And not just Milford Point, Sandy Point in West Haven is a good spot for them, and Long Beach in Stratford. And Connecticut Audubon is part of a group that we call the Audubon Alliance for Coastal Waterbirds. And we work with staff and a team of more than 100 volunteers around the state to protect the birds on these beaches. It's overseen by the State Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. And one of the things we do is when we find a nest, we put these sort of wire cages over the nest. They're big. We call them exclosures because they're designed to keep people and predators out. And the birds, the cages have enough room for the birds to walk in and out, but nothing else can get in and out, and nothing can get down through the top. So we do this every year at Milford Point and, as I said, Sandy Point and Stratford and Long Beach and Stratford and elsewhere. Usually we get, 8 or 9 or 10 maybe 12 nests at Milford Point, but this year we've had 16.
And wow. The 16
nests have produced 31 babies, which for Milford Point is the best year we know of on record. And I'll tell you why that's one of the reasons that's important is because if you do the simple division, that turns out to be an average of 1.9 babies per nest. And what conservationists think is over the long term to increase the population of piping plovers, you need an average of 1.5 babies per nest. So 1.9 compared to 1.5 is pretty good.
Oh,
yeah, it's an excellent year.
That's amazing. We have Tom Anderson here with the Connecticut Audubon Society, and we're talking about the piping plovers. I thought I knew exactly which birds you were talking about, because if anyone has ever seen, probably in my opinion, one of the cutest Pixar shorts called Piper. I don't know if you've ever seen it, Tom.
I have not.
Oh, Tom.
I'm not familiar with it.
I am going to email you a link to it. It's like maybe a 5-minute short film. It plays in front of, I don't remember which Pixar movie, but it's a Disney Pixar short film. Got a bunch of awards. It is so precious, and it's all about the piping plover. It's called Piper, but I didn't know what those birds were called. And I think this literally is exactly the bird you're talking about. I'm going to send you a link to it. But like you were saying, they stay on the beaches where they're so exposed. And I guess my question is, especially in Milford, so many flock to that area. And I know even when you walk between Silver Sands and Walnut Beach, there are some preserves up where it says you can't walk on this section of the beach. Why do you think we're seeing such success, record numbers of nests and babies this year compared to other years?
Yeah, a few things. Part of it is that We being Connecticut Audubon and the Audubon Alliance, do an increasingly good job of patrolling the beach and finding the nests and putting the cages around them, and also talking to visitors to make sure they know what's going on and they avoid the areas where the birds are nesting. So in addition to the exclosures that we put around the nests, we also put up string fencing, which is really just symbolic. It doesn't keep anybody out. Anybody who wanted to go in could go in, but it just gives people an idea of the range of where the baby birds would be. And so there's plenty of signs as well. So we do a good job of educating people about what to do and what not to do on the beach. And the other thing is, in the past, we've had coastal storms that coincide with high tides in May and June. And a couple of years ago, for example, a couple of those storms simply inundated the sandbar out there, which is where these birds nest, and wiped out the nests. And so the birds had to, if they had time, they had to try again. They had to, you know, make a new nest and lay new eggs. That didn't happen this year. We got some good luck from the weather. So we had combination of good luck and good cooperation from the public and a diligent job by the Audubon Alliance and by the three coastal rangers who work for us out there.
Well, hopefully we continue the trend and keep building this population up of the piping plovers. We're chatting with Tom Anderson, who is the Director of Communications for the Connecticut Audubon Society, and we were just telling the story about the piping plovers, tough little birds who live on the beach. And at Milford Point this year, a record number of nests and baby birds were born. And my question to you, Tom, is we saw a very incredible story of conservation efforts at its best and turning population numbers around in the best way. The bald eagle. This is a story that I know, like Greg Dantro at the Beardsley Zoo, he and I talk about it still so many years later, because I remember working at News 12 and doing the story when more and more eagles' nests were popping up, especially in like the Milford Beach area and around the state. Do you think we're seeing a similar trend with the piping plovers because of all the conservation efforts, or do you think this year was just kind of a fluke?
Well, it's a little bit different. The piping plover numbers are going up slowly but fairly steadily in Connecticut over decades. The difference is that the thing that killed off the bald eagles 50, 60, 70 years ago was the pesticide DDT, which was used extensively, especially after World War II, to control mosquitoes. And it also indirectly killed bald eagles, ospreys, peregrine falcons, because the pesticide, the DDT, got into the fish that they ate, and it when they ate, it built up in the birds, and it caused the eggs that they laid to not have enough calcium. So when they sat on the eggs in the nest, the eggs would crack. Mm-hmm. And you know, after years of that, obviously of no babies surviving because the eggs can't hatch, the population plummets. So because DDT was banned in the early 1970s, that gave those birds a chance over decades to come back. And obviously they have. I think last year in Connecticut, bald eagles nested in, something like 60 of the, 60 of the, I'm delaying because I have it here on my other screen, 67 of the state's 169 towns. And 50 years ago, there were effectively no bald eagles here. So that's a huge difference. And, it also shows that when the environmental problem is caused by a specific pollutant, you can go a long way towards solving the problem by just removing that pollutant from the environment. Piping plovers are a little different because the thing that's limiting their population increase is their habitat restrictions. They can only nest on beaches, and over the 50, 60 years or so, last 50 or 60 years, beaches have become more popular for people going to the beach, for one thing, but also as places to build houses, either right on the beach or nearby. And there are very few beaches that are left sort of wild and unraked for nature to be natural. Most beaches now are groomed, so they're more pleasant for people to go swimming and to go sunbathing. And so while the number of piping plovers is rising in Connecticut, the number overall has not changed significantly. There are only like 8,000 piping plovers left in North America. And that number, as far as I know, has stayed fairly steady. So it's not quite the same thing, but it also points to why the kind of intensive, really labor-intensive conservation work that Connecticut Audubon and the Audubon Alliance does is so important, because without that, the birds aren't going to survive at all.
Yeah, that's so true. So true. Well, I appreciate even the parallel and explaining both scenarios. And I'm always happy to hear about conservation efforts and seeing their good works and seeing the aftermath that something is working. And this morning talking about the piping plovers just makes my heart really warm. And I hope nothing but the best for their population numbers and that we continue to see success year after year. And Tom, thank you so much for the work that you do with the Connecticut Audubon Society. And I thank you so much for always making the time to come on WICC.
I'm always happy to be on. Thank you for asking.
Absolutely. And again, if you ever want to stay connected with the Connecticut Audubon Society, you can check out their website. It is ctaudubon.org. You can follow their newsletter as well. That's how I always keep in touch with what's going on. And again, it all starts at ctaudubononline.org. So if you want to go check it out, ctaudubon.org.
What's happening in Washington and how it affects you? Melissa in the Morning welcomes Congressman Jim Himes to WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
There's always a lot of drama heating up in Washington, D.C., but interestingly enough, one of the hearings that really caught my eye and some of you out there was the hearing in regards to UFOs and whether or not the government is hiding these UFOs. Do we know about alien life forms and we're just hiding it from the public? Congressman Himes, good morning. I know you and I have talked about interesting objects found in the skies before, but what is your take on the UFOs and the, I don't know, is he being called a whistleblower, the military man who's coming forward about his concerns of UFOs?
Yeah, good morning, Melissa. That's right. He is a whistleblower. He is or was an employee at the National Geospatial Agency, which is the agency that looks at the photographs that our satellites primarily take and does the interpretation. And what his claim is that he didn't see it, but he claims that he knows people and talked to people inside the Pentagon who discussed a program, I guess, to try to re-engineer some technology that they say was, basically a crashed alien spacecraft. Now, there was a hearing, and as you know, I've been involved in this as a ranking member of the Intelligence Committee for a long time. And, big picture here, I'll tell you that we live in an infinite universe, so the probability that we're all by ourselves in it is really low.
Mm.
I also think the probability that somebody would deliberately come see us across, hundreds of light years of space or whatever is also pretty low. But I'll tell you this, people ask me this question all the time. Obviously, it's an area of huge interest. It's practically a sort of a club or a cult of people who are desperately hoping that we've got aliens in Roswell or something. But I can tell you that over the years, I've asked dozens and dozens of Pentagon people, CIA people, NSA people, you name it, to tell me on the record whether we're holding spacecraft or anything like that. And to a person, they have said no. So, I suppose it's possible that dozens and dozens of people are committing the very serious felony of lying to a member of Congress. But I must say, this doesn't make me popular, but I am I'm a little skeptical.
I mean, the only thing, though, Congressman, is I was watching it because I do find the UFO conversation fascinating. I think people have talked about UFOs my entire lifetime. I've always heard people who have questioned it and so this is, to me, something that has gone on for a very long time. But they seemed very level-headed. When I'm watching it, these three military veterans who testified in Congress, I felt the main whistleblower. I thought he seemed very level-headed. He seemed very put together. And I will say I felt he also corrected so many times some of the lawmakers who would say, like, do you think there are little green men? Do you think there are aliens? And he's like, we don't really want to put a name on them because we just don't know. So I think the way that they used it were like non-human biologics, I think, is what they ended up calling it or something. I did think it sounded like, there could be something. And I just wasn't sure if you thought there is a chance that the government would be hiding this. Has this been an effort well before you were in office or anybody currently serving that something had to be covered up? UFOs had to be covered up.
Well, look, it's my job to be skeptical about these things and to do oversight of the Pentagon and of the CIA, et cetera. That's my job. And I will tell you the government's taking it seriously. The Pentagon could dismiss this and just say, oh, you people are crazy. But they haven't done that. They've put together a unit to look at all of the files, to interview people, et cetera, et cetera. So, I think the work is being done here to determine if there's anything credible here. And I'll tell you, I agree with you. These guys were not, you can meet out there on the street. You can meet people who are pretty clearly a little off their rocker on this topic. But these guys were credible. So we'll do the work. Now I'll tell you, I remain skeptical, right? As you've noticed, Melissa, and as America has noticed, it's really, really, really hard for the government to keep secrets, right? We had a 21-year-old airman up in Massachusetts who blew some of the, tightest held secrets that the United States have. We had Edward Snowden. Every single day there's leaks to the press. The government has a really hard time keeping secrets. And the idea that over, whatever it would be, 20 or 30 year period, we had an alien spacecraft, and that, of course, would have involved hundreds of people involved in, handling it or storing it or whatever else. The idea that hundreds of government employees are going to keep that secret over a period of many decades, that just feels improbable to me. But, like I said, we'll continue to ask the questions.
Yeah, no, that's definitely fair. I think what you're saying is totally fair. I am wondering, though, if it's like a, is it a question, though, Congressman Himes, of ignoring it for a long time, writing it off, putting it off? Like I said, I felt that the military members who spoke about this week were the most level-headed I think I've ever heard. In the past, whenever you hear about UFOs or claims about them or the photos and stuff, it's kind of, to me, it reminds me a lot of the people who say they've seen the Loch Ness Monster or they've seen mermaids. Like it, their testimonies sound very much like that. Whereas this felt more fact-based. This felt more, broad instead of like, yup, we know aliens are coming here. We know they're trying to communicate with us. Like this just felt more like, hey, let's be realistic. What in the world are those things flying in the air? You know, we're not looking for green men, but we definitely think there's something out there. Like this just to me felt like the first time that I was like, oh, I should pay attention to this because I've always written it off, to be honest. I always thought this sounds crazy. You know, and I remember growing up in the 90s and being like, this is nuts. This is not a real thing. Like, I do remember politicians being like, we're not even going to waste our time talking about this because this is foolish and there's more important things to talk about. So I'm wondering if it's a little bit of that. Like, hey, we just wrote it off for so long.
I agree with that. And, again, I will tell you, the government's taking this seriously, right? You draw an important distinction, right? There's a distinction between, you know, old Uncle Al who's had three or four bourbons and sees something in the, you know, sees something purple in the sky,
right,
and an F-18 pilot flying off a carrier in the Pacific who observes a phenomena and maybe even takes a video record of a phenomena. We've got that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things the government is doing, the Pentagon, is they're looking at, you know, hundreds of cases where not just a pilot has seen something. And why is it usually pilots? It's usually pilots because pilots have both instruments. They're trained to look for things that are anomalies in the sky. And, you know, they've been through hundreds of incidents. And it turns out that almost all of them, you know, are weather balloons, visual phenomena that happen when you're traveling at, Mach 2 in three dimensions in the dark. There's a few of these reported cases where they're not sure. And so, you know, again, I wish I could make history by saying that I know the right answer here. But there's still some uncertainty and, you know, government's doing its work and I'll keep asking the questions. By the way, you know, as you talk about it, I realize that we have a similar question coming up around artificial intelligence. We think, oh my goodness, is there extraterrestrial intelligence that was capable enough to come to planet Earth? If you follow the whole artificial intelligence thing, you realize that we may be growing intelligences right here on Earth, who have, you know, have human-like capabilities. So we may be struggling with what is it like to live with an artificial intelligence before we're actually confirmed that we know that we have extraterrestrial intelligence.
You're not wrong, Congressman Hines. This week we talked about that with Senator Blumenthal. I'm like, so how's the training going, learning more about AI? He's like, I definitely know more than I thought I would, but we still need a task force. He's like, because I have no idea what kind of safeguards we have to put in place. I mean, that is a whole different conversation. Oh my gosh, AI. Good grief. We're back talking with Congressman Jim Himes, and we have some developing news out of Washington, D.C. Congressman, it sounds like the crypto regulation bill just passed out of committee. First of all, what is that bill?
My Financial Services Committee, we spent the week and we made a little bit of history. We passed the first cryptocurrency regulation bill out of that committee. Now, it's obviously got a long way to go before it becomes law, but this is all about the crypto markets, Bitcoin and all of these various stable coins and everything that, you know, is speaking of new worlds, which is the theme of our conversation this morning. people are generally aware that everybody watched the FTX collapse. That's the exchange that was run by that 22-year-old guy, mm-hmm. Sam Bankman-Fried or whatever he was. You know, chaos in those markets, right? People have lost a lot of money over the course of the last year and a half or so on cryptocurrency. In fact, in the aggregate, lost almost $2 trillion, which is a staggering amount of money because you have kind of a Wild West going on with Bitcoin, with all the various different kinds of cryptocurrencies. So, yeah, we did two things. We passed two bills. One was a bill that would define what a stable coin is because, you know, there's a whole bunch of people, and a whole bunch of entities like Ethereum and other things that are saying, hey, you're going to pay for things at the market or buy a car with this stuff. And so we put a bill that would define what those are and create a regulatory structure around it. And then, FTX, which was, at the end of the day, corrupt, it was kind of a scam, exchange, we passed a bill that would set rules for those kinds of exchanges, those kinds of cryptocurrency brokers, et cetera. So, again, long path yet to go, but keeping with the theme of what we're talking about this morning, addressing something that, frankly, none of us had ever really heard about 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's so true. Now, with this bill, does it have bipartisan support? You know, what is the next step now that it's out of committee?
It did. It was, as you know, the Republicans are in the majority in the House, so most of the votes were in the committee were Republican, but I and six or seven Democrats joined the Republicans to make the bill bipartisan. So next step is it comes to the House floor, and then, you know, the usual question about what the Senate's going to do.
I mean, I would think this is a no-brainer. I don't know where you would have backlash towards it. Obviously, money is usually the big factor, but I agree. I think that this already proved that it could be a real monster. And if we don't get something in place to kind of have some sort of regulation and protections, I think we're just kind of opening Pandora's box now.
Yeah, that's right. And look, I mean, as I said before, an awful lot of people have lost a lot of money on Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a skeptic about what these things mean or what they'll do, you know. But hey, look, you've got a right to buy this stuff. What you do need is you need to be protected from bad actors like FTX, you know, that that maybe say they're going to be your broker, but then they take your money and collapse or whatever. So, yeah, you know, people obviously have the right to invest their life savings in Bitcoin if they want to. Not something I would recommend, but I'm not in the business of making financial recommendations. But at a minimum, they ought to be comfortable that the industry is operating, you know, with good oversight, and that the scammers and the con men aren't in the industry.
Well, Congressman Himes, I really appreciate you giving us the extra time this morning, definitely talking about some out-of-world stuff. But I do appreciate you bringing it to us here on WICC. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. Take care.
All right. Congressman Jim Himes here on WICC. We are welcoming back to the show Karen Kaiser, who is the Vice President of Philanthropy over at Hartford Healthcare St. Vincent's Medical Center. And tomorrow's the big show. We've got Swim Across the Sound back right here on the Long Island Sound. Karen, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Hey, Melissa. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Are you excited? I can't believe it's finally here.
It is finally here, and thank you so much for having me back. Yes, tomorrow is our big day. This is our 36th year doing this, but it's the first time that we're going statewide through Hartford Healthcare. We have several hundred volunteers, including boat captains, fire rescue, Coast Guard. So, yes, it's a major undertaking, but we could not do it without the support of all of our volunteers.
And I do know that registration to become a swimmer, that has closed. But how many swimmers do we have taking part in this year, Karen?
We have almost 200 swimmers this year.
Wow. Is that a record for us?
Yes. It is a record. It
wow.
is. And because of that, we have so many boat captains. We have almost 100 boat captains.
No kidding.
And we're still looking for more boat captains. If anybody out there is available, it's the best day on the water. We had our boat captains meeting this week, and many of them have been with us, some of them for the 36 years, and many new captains. But as boaters know, mechanical problems and things happen, and several have had to drop out. So if there are any boat captains that want to join us and help support, it is greatly appreciated. You can just go to our website, swimacrossthesound.org.
Now, Karen, I remember talking to one of the volunteer boat captains a couple months ago, and I believe, if I can remember what he had told me correctly, last year there weren't enough boat captains. So actually some swimmers had to be turned away, even though they had trained for this. We didn't have enough to make sure that swimmers safely got across. Are we running into that same situation this year, or is this mostly we're looking for boat captains as like a backup?
Right now, it's a backup because we have boat captains that are escort boats, so they stay with the solo swimmers and the relay swimmers. But then we also have perimeter boats, media boats, medical boats, lead boats. So our number one priority is the safety of our swimmers. So the more captains we have, the better.
And again, we have Karen Kaiser here, who is the Vice President of Philanthropy for Hartford Healthcare St. Vincent's Medical Center. And Swim Across the Sound is going into its 36th year, and tomorrow is the big shebang. We're going to see 200 swimmers taking to Long Island Sound and doing this incredible, to me, an accolade. The amount of training that goes into this is unbelievable. Karen, tell us why you think, I mean, this is a record number of swimmers this year. Why do you think so many people have gotten connected to the swim and want to take on this very challenging physical, event to take on Long Island Sound and swim?
Melissa, it is challenging. It's an open water swim that's 15 and a half miles. It starts at Port Jefferson and comes into Bridgeport. And it is challenging, but all of the swimmers that I have spoken with, they all have their own very personal stories. They're either swimming in honor of somebody or in memory of somebody. It's in their hearts. They just want to be able to help our patients that are going through cancer treatment. And it's not just our patients at St. Vincent's Medical Center. It's patients within our region. It doesn't matter which healthcare system that they're in. Another big reason that they're also doing this is because we are one of the top in the world. There's an organization called the World Open Water Swim Association, WOWSA, and we're in the top 100, meaning globally, this is one of the longest open swims.
Wow.
And a lot of the solo swimmers use this as a qualifying for other races, like the British Channel and many, many races. But most of our swimmers are doing it because they know somebody and they want to help future patients.
That's extraordinary, Karen. I didn't realize that it was so recognized on a global scale. That's incredible. How far are they swimming?
15 and a half miles, open water.
No big deal. Good Lord. That is just such an incredible, like I said, accolade to be able to complete this. And like you said, for so many, there's something personal attached to it. So even more heartfelt. If people want to donate to the swim, that's not closed. You could still donate to the swim anytime throughout the year. Would they just go to the website, Karen? What would you suggest?
Yes, the easiest way, and thank you, Melissa, it's swimacrossthesound.org. They can call our number at St. Vincent's, 203-576-6000, and just ask for the philanthropy department. But these swimmers that we have, they're not just coming from Connecticut. They're coming as far away as Wisconsin, North Carolina, Georgia, Florida. We even have a woman that I met last night from Mexico.
Wow.
So they're coming in from all over.
That's amazing. And can you give us, if you don't mind, just a quick rundown, Karen, if there are people, because I know I've gotten this question before and I forgot to mention it when we did our giving hour. If people want to just be present for this tomorrow, so they're not boat captains, they don't own a boat, they're not swimming, but they want to support Swim Across the Sound, what is sort of the rundown for tomorrow? What do people need to know?
So the day starts early for the swimmers. They arrive at the Port Jeff Ferry at 5:30 a.m., take the ferry over, and the first wave of swimmers goes in around 7:15 in the morning. But then back at Captain's Cove, somewhere, again, depending upon conditions, the first swimmers start coming in somewhere between 2 and 2:30 p.m. So everybody is welcome. It's open to the public. There's a huge celebration at Captain's Cove from 2 to 6:30. There's music, there's entertainment, all the shops on the boardwalk there at Captain's Cove are open, the restaurant is open. It's a huge celebration and so exciting to see these swimmers when they're coming in.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, Swim Across the Sound going into its 36th year, happening tomorrow, and it's going to be an amazing time. If you are a boat captain or you know somebody who is a boat captain, they are still looking for some, even in the last hours leading up to this event. So please be sure to check out swimacrossthesound.org and, of course, donate and support to the swim you could do as well on the website. Karen, thank you so much. I have loved talking to you leading up to this amazing event, and I look forward to being out there. there tomorrow and seeing some of the swimmers. It's going to be extraordinary.
Well, thank you, Melissa, for your support and WICC over the years. You guys have been unbelievable to us, and we cannot thank you enough.
Well, you are very welcome. It's one of the easiest organizations, I think, to get behind because, unfortunately, cancer touches everybody in some way, shape, or form. And the swim has supported so many families. I wish more states had an organization like the swim, but I'm blessed that we have it here in Connecticut. So thank you. Again, Karen Kaiser, the Vice President of Philanthropy for Hartford Healthcare, St. Vincent's Medical Center here on WICC. Lisa is a breast cancer survivor. She has directly benefited from the swim. In fact, her 14-year-old son is swimming this year to give back and to help other families like her family, thanks to programs like the swim. So joining us now is Lisa to share her story with us. A breast cancer survivor, are you in remission?
Yes, I am. I am a little bit over a year post-treatment, and I just had my big scans last week, and everything looks great, so I can say I'm 1 year cancer-free this year.
Oh, God bless you, Lisa. I'm so happy to hear that. Thank God. Thank God.
Yes, thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your story and how you benefited directly from the swim when you got your diagnosis.
About the summer of 2021 is when I found out that I had this lump and had to have it removed, and when they tested it, I was diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer, and so then began the treatment of chemo, surgery, chemo, radiation. And so I work in healthcare. I'm an occupational therapist. I work in home care. So it was a big debate. My doctor had recommended that I probably wouldn't be a good idea, especially during COVID, to work. So, you know, the financial strain, making that decision was hard, but the Swim Foundation helped a lot with making that decision. So I can say that, like, the whole process that Swim had, like, you know, interacting with our family and helping us was so easy. They made it very easy. And they take a lot of the financial, well, whatever they can, they have a certain amount allotted, of course, which I can't speak for. They help to, you know, they pretty much have a conversation with our family. What is it that you need? And so they helped us, like, with groceries. They gave us Stop and Shop gift cards. They helped with electric bill, car payments. So, you know, they said, like, what's the priority and what do you need help with? So that helped me to focus on, you know, fighting the battle of, you know, the emotional toll and all the stress that you have to deal with. It just took a lot of that off worrying about working.
Lisa, what is that like to see your 14-year-old sign up to now swim across the Sound?
Well, yeah, definitely emotional. I'm very proud of him. He is competitive and he's fearless. He's always a go-getter, and he signs up for something, he's going to do it. And I remember, like, he had to be like 10 or 11 years old. He said, I want to do that swim. He knew about it. And I was like,
wow.
Okay. You know, and I was like, okay, and didn't think anything of it. Then here we are. You know, I went through it. I was so grateful to have this swim help our family. And then he's like, yeah, I'm definitely doing it now. And, you know, it's just, I'm very, very, very proud of him and all of the swimmers. I think it's amazing what everyone's doing and very courageous. And it feels good to give back to, you know, they helped us and now we're going to help, you know, other people, you know, go through what I went through. So, yeah. My son's team, and I don't know, you know, the exact details of all the swimmers, obviously, but I know that they're one of the youngest teams. So his team is made up of, you know, he's 14, he'll be 15 next month, but between the ages of 14 and 18. So they're all teenagers.
Wow.
But, you know, they're on the club, the rapid swim team, and they, you know, they practice year round, usually 6 days a week. They swim 1 to 2 hours a day. So they, you know, they love swimming, and, you know, it's fun for them, because I asked him, like, are you nervous about this yesterday? He's like, not at all. He's not nervous. He's excited.
Oh, I mean, well, and to swim in your mom's honor, I don't know. Like I said, I've got the chills. It's amazing. Lisa, I'm so glad that you come from an amazing, supportive, clearly ambitious family. I'm also grateful for the swim and that it helped you. If you don't mind just finishing by telling people why they should support the swim, why they should donate year round, you know, maybe giving the perspective of if you didn't have the swim, What would that have meant during your treatment?
Yeah, I you know, we were really blessed to have a lot of family and friends and coworkers contribute to this. And a lot of people that did donate, they were like, 100% I'm in. The Swim Foundation is known to help so many people. And it's a feel good, you know that the money is going directly to the patient and the family. And so, you know, if anyone is looking to donate, I think this is just like the best. It helps local families, you know, that it's going right to them. And like I said, like when you're going through the cancer treatment, there's just so much on your mind, like this, not just the stress of the diagnosis and what's going to happen, but the stress of the finance on the family and how it's going to affect your family. And I can't tell you like how much the load off of my shoulders was to have that extra help. You could literally breathe easier. Okay, now I'm going to focus on getting my treatment and a little bit less on, you know, having to pay the bill, you know, that we have to pay. And not only just bills, you know, if I needed a wig or something, they would get that. Or, you know, it goes even further. Like, I'm still benefiting a little bit from it now because they allow like so many they give
therapies,
massages.
Yes.
Yeah. You can get acupuncture or massages. They allot like a certain amount of free ones. So I personally didn't get them during my treatment because I didn't feel well enough to. So now that I'm like rehabbing from getting chemo and surgery and all that stuff and working on getting stronger, I'm actually using those.
That's amazing.
And it feels good. So, you know, there's just a lot of things that they do, and they really try to personalize it to the patient and what your need is. And if they can do it, they'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's a beautiful story. And Lisa, God bless you. I'm so glad that you're feeling better. Good luck to your son and his team tomorrow. And if people want to donate, make sure you go to swimacrossthesound.org. Thank you so much, Lisa, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Melissa. Thank you so much, everybody who's a part of this.